and welcome to SSI Live. You've long known the Strategic Studies Institute, or SSI, at the U.S. Army War College as the go-to location for issues related to national security and military strategy, with an emphasis on geostrategic analysis. SSI conducts strategic research and analysis to support the U.S. Army War College curricula, assist and inform Army, DoD, and U.S. government leadership, and serve as a bridge to the wider strategic community. Now we're bringing you access to SSI analyses, scholars, and guests through this, the SSI Live podcast series. Thanks for joining us. Hello and welcome to this edition of SSI Live. My name is John Denny, and I'm a research professor of National Security Studies here at the Strategic Studies Institute. It's Wednesday, March 27, 2024, and we're going to talk about Russia today. Last week, Vladimir Putin was reelected, if we can call it that, to an unprecedented fifth term. It was an election in which he faced no serious challengers and which happened amid the strictest crackdown on opposition and free speech, arguably since the Soviet era. Now, relatedly, last month, we marked 2 years since Russia began its second and far more brutal invasion of Ukraine. As that war enters its third year, and as Putin basks in his quote-unquote reelection, I'm joined again by three of the most insightful Russia hands I know, namely Bob Hamilton, Craig Nation, and Steve Blank. Dr. Bob Hamilton is a research professor of Russian and Eurasian Studies at SSI and head of research at the Foreign Policy Research Institute's Eurasia program. Previously, Bob was a member of the teaching faculty here at the Army War College, and prior to that, he was an active duty colonel and a foreign area officer in the Army. He's written on and traveled throughout Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia. Dr. Craig Nation is a professor of history and international studies at Elizabethtown College in Pennsylvania and an adjunct faculty member at Dickinson College. Previously, Craig was the director of Russian and Eurasian studies at the U.S. Army War College, where he taught for 21 years. He's also taught at USC, Johns Hopkins, and Cornell. And Dr. Steve Blank is a senior fellow in FPRI's Eurasia program with Bob. Previously, he was a senior fellow at the American Foreign Policy Council, a DC-based think tank. And before that, he was a research professor of Russian studies at SSI for over two decades. He's taught at the Air War College in Alabama and at the University of Texas at San Antonio. Now, I've asked these three experts to join us again today to discuss Putin, the war in Ukraine, and Russia's future trajectory. So, gentlemen, welcome.
Glad to be there.
Thank you, Bob.
All right, let's start broadly and try to put Putin's election into historical context. And, Bob, I'm going to turn to you first. How do you think Putin sees himself here, or how do Russians see him? Is he in the mold, as some commentators have said, of Stalin or maybe even Catherine the Great, one of these long-term, impactful historical figures in Russian history? Let me ask you that first. Let's start there.
So I do think Putin sees himself as a historical figure and as one of a small handful of maybe truly historical figures in Russian history. You mentioned Catherine the Great, Peter the Great, Stalin, others, that he may be molding himself after. The problem is he has to bend history to his will. And he's been engaged in doing that at least since 2014 in Ukraine. Since 2014, I would argue that his legitimacy, the sort of social contract, which is never ratified through free and fair democratic elections, but nevertheless exists between the Kremlin and the Russian people. In the first two terms of Putin's presidency, 2000 to 2008, it was based on sort of the maxim, you stay out of politics and I'll help you get rich. And Russian real incomes did rise. But since the 2009 financial crisis, and then exacerbated by the 2014 sanctions and now the 2022 sanctions, Russian real incomes per capita GDP is essentially flat now. So since then, since his first two terms, his social contract or basis for legitimacy has been, I will protect you from the threat posed by the West. And I think the 2022 invasion of Ukraine was Putin in his eyes, pushing back, rolling back that alleged threat, which is really, it's a pathology in the Kremlin now, this idea that the West presents some sort of threat. They can't articulate the threat. Sometimes it's NATO enlargement, sometimes it's gay marriage, sometimes it's drugs, sometimes it's secularism. It's all these things.
All the time it's NATO.
Yeah, it's Well, it's NATO, but it's, you know, it's the fascists are coming over the wall. It's the gays are going to get your kids. It's a thousand things, none of which are real or even connected to one another. But anyway, my sense is since 2014, that's been Putin's interpretation of his role in history, is protecting Russia from the West and then rolling back this tide of Western, what he sees as a tide of Western encroachment.
I think to Western ears, so much of it, as you say, Bob, does sound just like overkill, right? I mean, do Russians see through that? Steve, what do you think? They view him in the same kind of historical light, or do you think they don't buy this?
I don't know what Russians actually buy, because I've gotten to the point where I'm skeptical of any kind of analyses of Russian public opinion. I think most people buy some of that, and they certainly expect him to be protect them. And on the other hand, they don't want, I don't think most Russians are happy about the war, but they've become indifferent to it as long as it doesn't directly touch them. And I don't think we're going to be able to get any kind of accurate readout on what Russian public opinion is. People are not going to tell the truth. People are not going to tell the truth about how they feel, the pollsters, because they know the government knows exactly where they live and what their kids are doing and so on. But Putin not only sees himself as one of these classic figures of Russian history, he sees himself particularly as a regatherer of empire and a defender of what used to be called Holy Russia, Svyataya Rus. And he has also become an arch reactionary. If there's any figure in Russian history that Putin resembles, it's Nicholas I, who also developed into that kind of reactionary mold and bequeathed to his successor a failing war in the Crimea. And on the other hand, there is a great deal of neo-Stalinism, if you take out the Leninism aspect of it, in the current picture. Because what we have is one of those periods in Russian history, and there are a lot of them, under Nicholas I, under Alexander III, certainly the later years of Stalin, or even to some degree the later years of Brezhnev, when you just have a feeling of heaviness and stagnation and fear, and real fear of the West in an attempt to assert a Russian nationalist, state nationalist identity. And obviously some of that resonates with the public, and it's a lot easier when you control all the media and have enormous repressive capabilities at hand.
Bob, you want to jump in? Go ahead.
Yeah, real quickly. Since, Steve, you mentioned sort of public opinion polling, what do the Russian people think? It's really interesting. The Levada Center, which I would argue is really the last and maybe only now legitimate public opinion research center in Russia, has asked since 1999, they've asked Russians in a poll, among the questions they ask are, what are you ashamed of? What causes you shame or upsets you when you reflect on Russian history in the 21st century? Every single time they've asked this for over 20 years, the number one choice out of about a dozen choices has been, we are a great people in a rich country, but we permanently live in poverty and disorder. So Russians are aware there's something wrong, right? Every single time Levada has asked this, that has been the number one answer from among 10 to 14 different choices that Russians get over more than 20 years, right? So they're aware something's not right. I don't think many of them know what to do about it.
Craig, let me turn to you and draw you into this. I want to ask you about this question specifically from your perspective as a historian here. What do you think this re-election tells us about changing continuity in Russian history and culture? I mean, I think what we just heard from Bob, it tells us certainly there's continuity in Russians' perspective, at least the last couple of decades, on their plight, frankly. But maybe more broadly, what do you think about this?
I think it's all about continuity. Most of you, I guess, know that Putin was my fellow student at Leningrad State University in the Brezhnev era. So,
not that you want to date yourself there, Craig.
Well, I can't help it. That's life. But
you probably have a file on you, Craig.
Anyway, he wasn't my best friend. Let me say that. But it's a shared experience of youth. In this time of zastoy, of stagnation, I think about that sometimes. Was trying to read Putin's mind. It's a very difficult job. How that kind of thing shape a person? Where they come from? I think we're missing a pretty important aspect of Russian political culture. It has no democratic tradition, virtually in effect none. It has an authoritarian political tradition. This is what the citizens have grown up with. This is what they've lived with. This is what their ancestors have lived with. Putin, in one sense, is a strong state thesis that he uses to justify, if you want to call it legitimacy, his governance. And it's widely shared in Russia. I think what was said about public opinion polling is justified, but my sense is that Putin is actually quite popular because he embodies values that have deep roots in Russian culture and historical experience. Strong ruler, strong state, disorder. Well, what Putin is measured against is 1990s. And what we have is a great deal of order in that comparative perspective. So I actually don't think that we should laugh at these election results. After all, the Levada Institute's poll is pretty consistent in giving him very high popularity ratings, around 80%. That's not far below 87%. Did you hear the lady from RT talking to the correspondent from Britain a couple of days ago? And he's asking her, well, there's no real opposition. Why should we have real opposition? She said, why should we have real opposition? That's your way. It's not our way. He's popular. We don't need real opposition. Nobody wants to be against him. She really sort of scolded him, but it sounded very Russian to me. And I think that's, we have to keep that in mind when we mock Putin. He embodies something that's deeply rooted in the mentality of the people he's governing.
We're not his audience.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Russians are his audience. Maybe right-wingers in the United States or in Europe are his audience, but academics, certainly not. Second, he has brought back, as Craig suggests, the traditional Muscovite autocracy. The state owns a national economy. The elite holds its property not by virtue of contract or law, but by virtue of state service. And he can take it away anytime he wants. And we see this happening with reasonable frequency. There's an article recently in the press that they have nationalized $10 billion in the last 2 years. That's firms that they either took over or the Western owners sold out. But it points to the fact that what you have here is something that I think any intelligent czarist official, if he came back today, would recognize within a half an hour. Mm. And it, as Craig said, it embodies deep values in Russian political history, in Russian culture, and Russian popular culture. Not Dostoevsky, Tolstoy, Tchaikovsky, Stravinsky, but the street culture, the popular culture, and the criminal culture, for sure. And as a result, there's a genuine popularity there. What the real percentage is, there's no way of knowing. But this is a regime that has real roots in the country. It's not just artificial.
If this is cultural, and given what we know or what sociologists tell us about, or the typical immutability of culture, its reluctance to change or only changes over time. Let me ask the three of you now to cast your gaze not to the past, but to the future. What does Putin's reelection tell us about the trajectory of Russia? I mean, I gather from what I'm hearing from at least two of you, it's frankly more of the same.
Yeah. I mean, assuming he serves his full term out and all things being equal, it would be more of the same. A major shock to the system from outside. For example, if they lose the war in Ukraine, has the potential to create some sort of upheaval. And I believe if they did lose in Ukraine, it would. But otherwise, all things being equal, we're going to get more of the same as long as Putin is there and as long as his system is there. I don't know that the system will survive him, but otherwise, in the absence of any major shock to the system from within or without, yes, it's going to continue more or less along predictable lines.
Like, now, Steve, I'm going to push back on something. I'm going to ask you, Craig, you're going to respond to this, I hope. But, Steve, you just mentioned that as long as Putin's there. I mean, that implies this is Putinism. And I think what I just heard from you previously was, no, this is not Putin. This is, in fact, embedded in Russian culture, practically in the DNA. Craig, are you going to – can you weigh in on that?
Steve used the word system, sistema. This is in Russian political and cultural analysis. This is a famous term, and it's something besides Putinism. Putin in this context is a product of sistema, not a manifestation unto himself. Russia had an opportunity. I don't want to say that Russia is condemned by culturally to autocratic governance. It had an opportunity to move away in the context of the collapse of the Soviet Union, and it made some progress, in my opinion, and it has an institutional outline that could be called potentially democratic if it worked the way it's supposed to or it looks on paper. One of the real tragedies of the many tragedies of this war underway is it's rolled that back dramatically, today's Russia looks a lot more like what you were describing right up out of the starting gate here, repression of dissent, really regressive effects. Now, whither all that? Yeah, famous question. Kuda. it's very hard to predict.
Bob, I certainly don't think
that Russia is not going to lose this war.
Oh, okay. So we'll come back to that.
Yeah.
We'll come back to the war in a few minutes. Bob, let me ask you to weigh in though on this issue or question of the trajectory. What's this tell us about Russia's future direction?
Yeah. So first, I would use a horrible political science term to describe the relationship between Putin and the sistema, and that is mutually constituting. Right. He is influenced by it, and then it's a feedback loop. He influences it, and he has been able to influence the sistema, the structure of the political system, to mold it to his liking, but he's also a product of it, right? He's a product of the security services. He reflects the foreign policy and national security consensus of the Russian political elite. In terms of going forward, more of the same, but with, I think, more personalization and declining capacity, because Putin, if he stands for re-election in 2030, will be 78, would make him young for a U.S. presidential candidate, but for given Russia's life expectancy, especially male life expectancy, he's old. He will be very old. And so I think you can see declining capacity, declining mental and physical energy over this next 6-year term, combined with an increased personalization and deinstitutionalization of governance in Russia, which could possibly lead to more miscalculations and mistakes.
Now, let me ask you all to take us beneath the level of the state. Now, we talked a little bit about the lack of an opposition and the views of some, maybe the fact that Russia maybe doesn't need an opposition. There's no tradition of a political opposition. But what can we say about Russian civil society? Clearly, in the political realm, it seems that civil society has either been dismantled. Or it frankly just it doesn't exist any longer at all. If that's the case, what about divisions within the government? And I don't mean divisions as in disagreements per se, but institutional actors within the government having maybe differing views on Russia's direction, on its policy, on its strategy, whatever. And I'm talking about mainly institutions like the military, the FSB, that is the successor to the KGB, oligarchs and business elites, and the Kremlin itself, that is Putin's court. These are all different institutional players within the system. Do you see differences of viewpoint among them, or are they all still now in lockstep under Putin's guidance and direction?
Well, I think you have – the term civil society doesn't fit Russia. We had a moment in the 90s when communism fell apart and oligarchs and other people were making lots of money. It was a possibility. But historically, there has been little or no civil society, because the term originates with 18th century British philosophers, or Scottish philosophers more precisely. And it denotes those people who have real economic assets outside of government control. So you need a legal state, not a democracy, but a state of law, and some recognition that private property is guaranteed by law. That's not the case in Russia. So you have a lot of professional people, a lot of intelligentsia, to use the old Russian term, but they don't have independent economic assets. And the oligarchs certainly do not have independent economic assets. I mean, look at the number of energy executives who were killed early in this war. Something was happening there, and they just took these guys out and killed them, and they, you know, their assets were taken over. End of story. Or even earlier, people like Khodorkovsky or Berezovsky and so forth. So I really do not like to see the term civil society used with regard to Russia, because I don't think it fits. Now, with regard to the second question you posed, we really don't know what these individuals privately think, and they're not going to tell us. I mean, I remember, you know, reading a wonderful biography of Khrushchev by William Taubman, which I recommend to everybody, that nobody had any idea that Khrushchev thought he could run this system after 1949, but he certainly was intending to, and nobody had any idea where he was going to take it. And he took it in some pretty different directions than it had been going. And then, you know, Brezhnev and company tried to sort of back it up and reverse it. And they, you know, they just ended up in this complete stagnation. The problem is that with the absence of institutional checks on power and the absence of a rule of law state, or Rechtsstaat, to use the German term, nobody has any idea what a successor will do, not even the successor. And he's not talking, because he's going to, my personal opinion, he's going to come into power as part of a coalition, try to strengthen himself to become number one. But when he begins to see the reality around him and has the capacity to do something about it, he's going to realize that there are terrible problems here that must be addressed. So he will try to do something different without unduly shaking the entire structure, like Khrushchev. Of course, Khrushchev ended up shaking it far too much. But that, to me, is the likely course of a succession.
So according to your view, Steve, it seems like we're not going to know who that person is until the moment arrives they reveal themselves in some way. Bob, Craig, let me ask you to weigh in on this issue also. I think what I'm really asking when I get at this issue of the demise of civil society or the role of institutional actors within the system, have we reached the point where Putin has basically achieved a totalitarian state, or is that the direction we're heading in? What do you think?
Well, John, I mean, I think you're right to focus on an elite split as a greater threat to Putin than a popular uprising. And Craig knows this better than I do, but the history of popular uprisings over the last, 1,300 years of the Russian state is pretty meager. Most changes, extra constitutional changes of government in Russia have taken place through elite splits of some sort. Even the November 1917 revolution was a coup more than it was a popular uprising. The February revolution, you could argue, is a popular uprising. But so it's going to be an elite split, I think, that causes the next collapse, the next extra constitutional change of government in Russia. Putin has co-opted or destroyed many of the centers of elite power outside of himself in the Kremlin. But I don't know. I mean, the last real threat, I think, was Prigozhin, Wagner, that, and you saw how they dealt with that. I'm with Steve. I don't think the oligarchs are a big threat. He's expropriated or killed most of them. So there probably will be some split within the Kremlin. I don't know where it might emerge. Maybe between the military and the security services. Maybe again between the military, because Wagner's got not gone. It's just been channeled into Redoute and some of these other Kremlin-linked private military contractors. So I think an elite split will come. I mean, Putin's regime will not give up power constitutionally and willingly. It will collapse at some point.
Craig?
Gorbachev was a product of an elite split. The Soviet elite, below the surface, was deeply divided. You saw that in the post-Brezhnev transition. You had Ustinov and Chernenko from left to right and back again. And I think that that kind of succession in a post-Putin era should not be ruled out as an impossibility because of this weight of tradition that we're talking about. It is a possibility that we have a renewed reformist impetus in a post-Putin era. Putin has obviously stayed too long already. What skews this all is the war underway. Steve, I think that Steve's definition of civil society could be broadened. Conventional usage today, as I understand it, it refers more to this spontaneous citizen interaction outside of the eyes of the state. Citizens doing things, bowling leagues, sort of a kind of interaction. They're not overseen or supervised by the state. Certainly, that was almost impossible in the Soviet Union. The state was a powerful, centralized, repressive police state. That's basically what Soviet Union was. It's become more possible in post-Soviet Russia, I believe. This shaman, for instance, against the background of this atrocity in Krokus, is an example of that. This cult of the rock singer that brings young people together is a manifestation of that kind of way of defining civil society. That's there. It's not a closed route. And I think it can grow peacefully out of a process of transition. The disaster is this war, and that Putin was able to run for another term. He should have stepped down. Should not have been war. Putin should have stepped down and retired. Like I should.
No, we want you to stick around for Putin to leave.
No.
Open the windows and let the wind come in. That would have been a good solution. But the war is aggravating one of the ways in which Putinism brings Russian civil society, if I can divide it in that broader sense, together. And that is offended patriotism. And this is deep, and it was widespread in the Soviet Union, talking to the average Russian Soviet Union. You don't like us. They don't like us over there. They don't respect us. They talk bad about us. We have a great culture. We have a great country. We have a great civilization. We should be proud of it. And you disrespect us. That has always been in the Soviet Union and still today, widespread attitude. And of course, this Krokus business is going to aggravate. And it's going to, however, we have a dialogue arguments. We say something called the Islamic State of Khorasan in it, and Russia's going to say, obviously, they're hinting all over the place that Ukraine is involved. That serves their purposes. To give new legitimacy to intensification of the war effort. I think we'll see that happen. That will happen. And, Soshenia Voyna, this is the population will be behind it. We'll support it.
Craig, you've mentioned the war several times now, and this is a good segue to what I want to get at next. And that is, what are the implications of this reelection for the war effort? And Craig, you've made it clear you think it's going to be an intensification of some sort. Could that include another round of mobilization? What do we foresee now for the trajectory of the war itself?
It's hard to predict. Obviously, the Russians don't tell us what they're about to do, and there's all sorts of speculation about what it is. And I don't have access to sources which might enable me to speak intelligently about that. But if I had to pull a rabbit out of my hat, I predict that we're going to see an intensification, maybe a real offensive, justified as a response to this terrorist atrocity. It will be an intensification of the war, and Ukraine will be hard pressed to stand up to it.
Bob, I see you nodding. You agree?
I do, yeah. And I think, yeah, the Krokus attack will be used as justification for an intensification of the war against Ukraine, possibly for another partial mobilization of several hundred thousand people. I think Russia will focus on the war, the ground war, because the ground war is the part of the war in which it's making some albeit limited, progress, and progress really that, you know, Ukraine's problems are lack of manpower, which it's got to solve itself, and lack of weapons, which is our fault, frankly. And that may be solved, but the manpower problem Ukraine is going to have to deal with, and they may have to lower it right now. It's, I think, 27 and above. Only people 27 and above in Ukraine are subject to being involuntarily mobilized. That may have to change because I think you're going to see an intensification of the Russian ground campaign. Just try to grind out these daily incremental gains and exhaust and attrit Ukraine until Russia is able to gain enough ground that it can declare victory.
Steve, what do you think?
Well, I agree with my colleagues here. I mean, Russia right now has the upper hand. There are a fair number of analysts who think that this operation in some ways resembles and may well have been the Crocus terror operation may have been a false flag, like the Chechnya war that had the apartment bombings in Moscow, and then the famous Ryazan sugar story where they caught these guys actually setting explosives, and they said it was just an exercise and they were using sugar sacks. Either way, the government is intensely focused on trying to use this to mobilize support. So far, they have not, it hasn't played well in the West. I don't know how it's playing in Russia, but because you can't tell, there's no way to calibrate that. But as Bob and Craig have said, they are going to use this opportunity to try to mobilize people and energize patriotic spirit and the resentments that we have talked about that you hear against the West in order to launch another big offensive. In the meantime, we're going to have these attritional attacks, but I think they want to play real hardball and really launch a big offensive because they think it's going to succeed. Now, whether or not it succeeds depends obviously on Ukraine's ability to resist. And frankly, as Bob said, on our getting off the dime and giving them the assistance they need. And that's critical.
Gentlemen, we're almost at the end of our time together here for this podcast, but let me ask you one last question. This will be the lightning round. Let's bring it home, so to speak. Let me ask you what advice you would give this administration about what it should do differently, if anything, maybe nothing different in the short run, given the war and the sanctions, et cetera, we have placed in response against Russia. But what advice would you give to policymakers right now regarding the implications of this reelection? What does it mean for U.S. relations, such as they are, with Russia? What do you think?
Well, I have four things I'd have them do. One, to use a basketball metaphor, a football metaphor, flood the zone with weapons for Ukraine. Two, intensify sanctions to take out Russia's energy industry, because that's what allows Russia to fund the war. Three, the president and his top lieutenants, that is the vice president, the secretaries in the cabinet, and maybe Sullivan at NSC, need to go out to the country and say, we want to see Ukraine win. We have a strategy. This is the strategy. This is what it is. We want to see our allies supported and build public support for that. They have failed to do this. And as a result, they are losing public support as we speak. And fourth is, of course, strengthen the backbone in NATO to build a strong European defense industry, whether it's a European defense industry or members combining their national industries together in an effective way to increase the defense of Europe. And that also means strengthening the EU's capability to play the role, the political role it envisages for itself. If you do those four things, not only do we have a chance for Ukraine to win, we have a chance to really advance European security in a way that has not happened for over a generation. Otherwise, we're going to suffer a major strategic political defeat, regardless of how the American election comes out.
Craig, let me turn to you. Would you agree with that list of four things? Would you add to it or change it?
I would subtract everything. I don't agree at all. I'd give very different kind of advice.
Okay.
Steve and I are old friends. We're used to it. I think, of course, the Biden administration is going to try to protract the sort of stalemate notion through the November election. What comes next? I don't think that there's a military solution that will work to our advantage. It's just not there. Those things can't be done effectively. Russia's too strong to overwhelm that way. And the risks are very high of entering into that kind of conflict. I don't think it's a winning strategy. And I don't think we should announce it to anybody if we intend to do those things. Beyond that, what's the solution? It is to work towards this infamous word, a negotiated solution, which the great beneficiary of which will be Ukraine and the Ukrainian people won't be blown apart and destroyed in an open-ended paroxysm of violence. That would require giving Putin at least a partial win. It's hard to swallow, but that's realistic. And that means territorial concessions. It means Ukrainian neutrality. We can forget about the so-called fascists in government. You don't have to worry so much about them. It doesn't have to mean regime change in Kyiv. Remember, Ukraine is the same political culture as Russia, by the way. You talk about the dilemmas that Russia faces. Ukraine is the same. They were the same country for 400 years, most of them. What will be the result? A shrunken Ukraine, but an intact and independent Ukraine with adequate security guarantees. They'll have a renewed relationship, probably an open border with a Russian neighbor. The territorial surrenders won't be that hard to live with. In my opinion, it's a more realistic course of action to envision. It doesn't have to be announced either, but it can be worked towards.
Bob, let me turn to you to get the last word. Where do you fall between these two extremes of your colleagues here?
So first, Craig, I agree that Russian and Ukrainian political cultures are similar. I would offer one caveat. Ukraine doesn't suffer from an imperial hangover that manifests itself in aggressive and expansionist territorial designs on its neighbors, right? So Russia has launched, all four of us here have taught just war theory here at the Army War College, right? Russia has launched a war that is illegal in terms of whether you want to talk about jus ad bellum, justification for war, or jus in bello, just conduct in war. It's launched an illegal war. It is committing war crimes, not as aberrations, not as the result of bad actors lower in the chain of command. It is committing war crimes as an integral part of its strategy. So in its strategy in Ukraine, one of the strategic directions is the institutionalization of war crimes. In other words, because they believe it's a shortcut to victory, and as long as they win the war, no one goes to The Hague. That's been the Kremlin thinking in the Second Chechen War. It was the Kremlin thinking in Syria, and it's the Kremlin thinking now. I would say Russia has to lose this war, or Russia can't win this war. Dara Masiko is one of the best Russia analysts there is, has said, if Russia wins this war, we're going to be faced with a bruised, vengeful Russia that believes it has beaten the West, and it's only a matter of time before it rebuilds and it attacks somewhere else along its periphery. I think that's correct. And I would say the best way to make sure Russia doesn't win this war is continued aid to Ukraine. I crunched these numbers back in December, and these are U.S. Department of Defense numbers. Military aid to Ukraine, U.S. military aid to Ukraine through December was $43 billion. We've only given it $300 million since. So $43 billion, which represents 2.7% of our defense budget over the 2 years of the war. So for that 2.7% of the U.S. defense budget, Ukraine has destroyed 315,000 of the 360,000 active troops Russia had in its army on the eve of the invasion, 2,200 of 3,500 tanks, and one-third of the Black Sea Fleet. So Russia is the most acute militarized threat that the U.S. faces right now. And right now, Ukraine is doing more than anyone in the world to damage Russia's ability to threaten the U.S., its allies and partners. So we need to keep funding its ability to do that.
So we're fighting to weaken Russia, not to save Ukraine.
No, we're fighting to save Ukraine, of course. We didn't start this war. Russia started the war.
The benefit is weakening Russia. I feel this is unethical from our side. If we're in the war this deep and it's that important, we should intervene.
We can talk about that.
That would be an interesting discussion.
That'll be a topic.
That's a different podcast.
Right, Bob.
That's a discussion I'm happy to have, but.
That's a conversation for our next podcast. Gentlemen, this conversation has lived up to every expectation I had for it. So I am grateful. Dr. Bob Hamilton, Dr. Craig Nation, Dr. Steve Blank, another enlightening discussion amongst the three of you. I am really grateful. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
Thanks, John.
Thanks, everybody.
You can now find SSI Live on TuneIn Radio and on popular podcast directories like Stitcher and at the iTunes Store. If you have any comments on our podcasts, thoughts on what you'd like to see addressed, or a response to something you heard here at SSI Live, please go to our website. That's ssi.armywarcollege.edu. Find me, John Denny, in the staff directory, and send me an email. I look forward to hearing from you. For the SSI Live podcast series, I'm John Denny. Thanks for listening.